This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3100 for Friday the 19th of June 2020. Today's show is entitled For Your Consideration, Maker's Corner, and is part of the series Podcast Recommendations. It is hosted by Ken Farlon and is about 76 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is, Maker's Corner is a tech-oriented DIY podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hi everybody, this is Ken bringing you a recommendation for a new podcast. If you're into making or hardware hacking and integration with Raspberry Pis, Arduinos, soldering, that sort of thing, then Maker's Corner with Nate and Yannick is a podcast for you. It's a tech-orientated DIY podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. They've released a few shows already. I must say that I was very slow to subscribe to this one, but I rapidly caught up, and it is an excellent podcast, and I'm glad to bring it to you today, especially as they are having an interview with John and Phil about the 32 Built project. Also features some headphone stuff. So this is not a typical episode that they do, but I thought that it would be an ideal opportunity to expose this interview, because it's very interesting, to the HPR audience. So their website is makerscorner.tech. And sit back and relax and enjoy the rest of the show.
This podcast is part of the Other Side Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Maker's Corner episode 4. My name is Yannick, I'm the French guy from Switzerland, and joining me for this episode, as always, my friend and co-host, Nate. Hello Nate, how are you?
Great, how are you doing?
Well, snow is back, but the daylight is back too, so all in all, I'm a little better than I was a few weeks back when I was driving to work in the dark, so the mood is better. And we have a fantastic show tonight. So
it's harder to fall asleep when you're driving if it's light out.
Yes, yes, yes. Which is something that almost happened during every morning of the winter. So
yeah, those winter drives are something else.
Yeah, yeah. On tonight's show, we have that interview with John and Phil that we talked about on our last episode that. Couldn't happen before, what was it, last Thursday, I think we recorded that. So we are on March the 3rd today, so we recorded that, I think, the 29th of February, I guess. So we're going to feature this interview in this episode. Also, we're going to talk with you, Nate, about what you've been up to this fortnight, and then we will close the episode with the Thingiverse thing of the episode. So, Nate, what have you been up to this past 2 weeks?
I've been learning electronics with my oldest boy. He's almost 9, and he's taking this electronics engineering class, and it's been a lot of fun kind of relearning some things that I have forgotten, and then and working with him on teaching him how to properly do circuits. Yeah, we've got some breadboards, and It's a plan. EMI.co is the website that it's kind of through, but it's part of his schooling. And this last time it's went from just having very simple circuits with switches and LEDs to now we're doing doing stuff with transistors now. Mm-hmm. And I got to explain to him like this little PNP and NPN transistors sometimes they're hard for me to grasp at times, when they pull down or how to pull them down or anyway. But it's funny to think about like how many millions or maybe billions of those transistors are in, a phone or a computer. It's just amazing to think about.
It's amazing.
How far things have gone. When you look and you just kind of pause and you think about the vacuum tube, how that was the precursor to the transistor and how big that is. And then the transistor got a lot smaller and they started packing these things tighter and tighter and tighter. And now we have, now they're so
millions,
extremely tiny. And I don't know, it makes me really appreciate all the technology we have today and how awesome, pick your poison, Raspberry Pi, Arduino, or Blit32. What amazing technology we have today that we can play with, and I don't know. I'm going to mumble a little. I'm just going to ramble here on, but it's amazing to see all that we have now compared to what it was just 20, 30 years ago, and there's just a lot more appreciation that I can re-garner just from doing this electronics class with my 8-year old.
So did you yourself learn something with this electronic course?
A little bit, yes. I mean, these are things I already kind of know, but it's nice to have kind of the reformalization of the education because I'm pretty much self-taught on most of it. And I did take an electronics class in high school. That was, the 1990s was 5 years ago, right? Yeah.
Yes.
So 5 years ago. So there's those classes there, and I built circuits, and I've fixed things and whatnot, so I understand the concepts, and I have the multimeters and whatnot. I don't have an oscilloscope yet, but that's something that every mad scientist really needs to have.
That's something I've put in my wish list for last Christmas, but
Santa didn't bring it.
Yeah, no.
Well, maybe you weren't good enough.
maybe I just didn't buy myself one. It must be fun to be able to follow along with your kid. So I guess he's learning from school, so you're learning things, but probably you're teaching him also stuff, and that must be very
it is
very nice for you.
Teaching him things like circuits in parallel and circuits in series and whatnot. There's a lot of little basics, and he enjoys it. It's fun for him. He's excited to do it, and I told him once we get through this next round of projects, then we're going to take apart his broken tablet and we're going to see if we can actually get that thing working again. So,
cool. Yeah. But at the end of the day, that those parallel and series circuits and Ohm's law, it's basically all you need to do some electronics. So
pretty much. Yeah. Because I'm not going to be tearing into any chips, but if you can get the stuff, if you can understand the things around the chips, all the resistors and capacitors and everything else, then that's kind of that's all the foundational stuff to be able to, fix stuff yourself. So,
yeah. Once you know how to do a RC circuit, when you know how to do a voltage divider, you're pretty much, you have all the basics you need.
The world is opening.
Yes. On my side of the Atlantic, I was busy this week, playing with the 32 Blit. I reflashed the firmware because I think it was last month since I did that, and a lot have changed, as you will hear in the interview in this last month. So I did that. I had a look at the code. I joined the Discord server and I met a wonderful community there. I also submitted a couple of pull requests, nothing fancy, just fixing a problem with a sample and fixing some displays that were not exactly as they should be, just to kind of dip my toes into the in the water just to see how this thing is working. And now I'm exploring the APIs. And this thing is really amazing. It's an awesome device. But I will let Phil and John from Pimory tell you all about that in the interview. So I guess we're going to go to the interview now, and then we will come back to close this episode with the Thingiverse thing of the episode. So I'm joined tonight with by John and Phil. Good evening, guys.
Hey, Yannick.
So you guys work for Pimorony, and we are going to talk about the project that I like in I like all of your project, but the one that I'm really into right now, and I have it there. I'm going to show it on the camera.
Hey.
Yeah, that's the beta version, or is it beta early access? I don't know how you call that.
It's beta.
A beta unit of the 32-bit platform. We talked about that on the podcast 2 weeks ago, two episodes ago. So why don't we start by a small introduction? So guys, if you want to introduce yourself, maybe John, if you want to start.
Yeah, sure thing. I'm John Williamson, and I'm one of the co-founders of Pimorony. So I started the business with Paul Beach in 2012. And since then, it's kind of grown into an uncontrollable beast that makes lots of PCBs. And 32-bit is kind of our latest, most ambitious project.
And I'm Phil Howard, and I sort of joined, 7 years ago now, quite a while, as employee number 11 or something like that. And I am software lead writing Python drivers for basically all of the products we release, and kind of keeping on top of that game and keeping stuff released, and taking a break to work on 32-bit has been really quite interesting.
All right. Yeah. So 32-bit, that's the subject of this I was going to say interview, but let's call it chat, because I'm curious about that. So how would you describe the 32-bit? Is that a device? Is that a platform? How would you describe that?
So it's I think the way that I would describe it, it was kind of my concept originally. Is that it's the piece of hardware I wish I had back in the kind of early 90s that I could have developed games for. Because obviously back then, everything was very different. The technology was a lot harder to get into. The cost of things like dev boards was massively higher. As a hobbyist, you had no hope of even touching this kind of stuff. And we're really fortunate that, you know, today you can grab a powerful MCU off the shelf. You can stick it on a PCB that can be made for a reasonable price. You know, there's such a wealth of features, sensors, devices out there that we can play with. We can integrate and kind of produce a product like this. So it's, for me personally, I wanted a standard platform, hardware platform, for developing kind of retro inspired games.
Cool. Yeah. So it's the hardware, but you're also working on the firmware. So that's been released. It's open source, right? The firmware?
Everything's indeed, open source. Yes. Hardware, firmware, everything. Tools, content, everything open source.
So was the open sourcing, was that like from the beginning you were going to open source everything, or was that like, okay, we need help, we can't do that alone, so let's open source that and have people help us?
It was all open source from the very start. It was actually part of the pitch. We launched the product on Kickstarter because it's quite a nice marketing platform for presenting something that's new. Like, we've done Kickstarters before, we obviously run our own shop. We produce a lot of products, most of them we don't go near Kickstarter because it's just not necessary. But for this, we kind of wanted a focal point for launching the product, and a Kickstarter campaign seemed like a good choice. And you'll see in the Kickstarter campaigns kind of a description about what 32-bit isn't, and that is, it's not your classic handheld console. It has no DRM. It's all open source. It's not region locked. It's designed to be hacked. You know, it's the anti handheld console, if you like, because everything about it is not how traditionally this stuff is done. And we appreciate that there are other products out there that also hit those goals. Like, we're not the only ones. There's things like the Arduboy, Gameduino. I think, you know, Adafruit have got a couple of things around that kind of space as well. But I think from my point of view, what I felt they were missing is they just didn't have the power to do the things I wanted to do. You know, I want to play with like 3D engines, and I want to mess around with fixed point math to do crazy effects. I want to do alpha blending. I want to render everything in 24-bit color. You know, it's not, I don't want to move black and white pixels around a tiny OLED. I want something more than that. And that's what 32-bit is.
I think the power of 32-bit exceeded our expectations somewhat as well, which has been interesting.
Yeah, when I read the description on the website or on Kickstarter, there's a lot of awesome hardware on the 32-bit. So can you know one of you go over what kind of device with a chip is there? What kind of sensor?
So I'll talk about the chip and the display maybe, and then Phil could take on from there.
Indeed.
I think the thing that made 32-bit possible, as in made it into something that could achieve all those things that I mentioned before that I really wanted out of it, was this particular chip coming out from STM. So it wasn't like we had a plethora of choice. It was this particular chip coming out that suddenly sparked the idea that this kind of product could be possible. You know, it's fast. It runs at 480 megahertz. That's fast for an MCU, right? You can shift a lot of instructions at that kind of speed. It has a megabyte of RAM on board, which again is pretty rare in this kind of space. The flash is tiny, you know, 128K compared to the rest of the specs, but that tends to be the case within an MCU package anyway. Flash is very expensive to manufacture in that technology, so we put an external flash on to kind of support it. But it, you know, it's got a hardware floating point unit. It has incredible instruction and data caches. So like even when you write bad code, it kind of runs fast. It's a very nice piece of hardware.
And I've written plenty of bad code to prove this, of course.
And because of the choices they made, and the other thing is it's part of their value range. So the actual chip isn't incredibly expensive. Like, you know, I can't remember exactly, but you're talking around $5, which for all that power is pretty incredible. And then on top of that, because it's an ST part, you know, it's got a huge number of great peripherals. So things like the DPI interface for the video, which is what we use to drive the LCD, that means that we can have that kind of rock solid V-synced 60, well, I think we run it at 50 hertz, 50 FPS. Display in 24-bit color, which you're just not going to get out of an SPI connected display, right? And things like that DPI interface, it's entirely hardware accelerated. So, you know, we write to a frame buffer in memory. We tell what's called the LTDC peripheral where that frame buffer is, and it handles the rest, right? It tells us if V-sync's going to happen so that we can get out of the way and let it do its thing. But all of this kind of happens in the background. This part's amazing. It's just a really great chip.
It really is.
Huge number of features. It's cost effective. And literally everything that 32-bit does is done in that chip. You know, and you know, we've got audio running in the background. We've got kind of the image flipping happening. You've got the engine itself running, timers, tweens. There's all these different processes that are going around in the background. But still, the user's code has like 90% of the chip's performance available to it. It's a really nice part. I could carry on talking about it almost indefinitely, so I'm going to stop there.
There are so many features we're not even using as well. For people following along at home, it's the STM32H750. And because we're using a not ball grid array part, we have to pick and choose what features we can actually wire into it. They become kind of mutually exclusive in a way.
So you get kind of out of pin errors quite regularly as you try to, you know, the DPI interface alone uses something like 18 pins.
It's a pin monster, yeah.
It'll be a few more than that, about 20 pins. Phil mentioned a good point. The other thing is that this chip's available as a TQFP package. So you could literally hand solder one of these at home. We use a machine for it, obviously, but it's not a completely inaccessible format for people to experiment with, which is cool.
You can get oscilloscope probes on it as well, which has proved to be very handy in the debugging process.
And then the only other bit of hardware that I was going to talk about was the screen. And we are super nerdy about screens. Like, I will not buy a device that has a poor screen on it. So, you know, we've gone for a really nice 3.5 inch. It's a good size screen for the handheld console. You know, I think it's a nice balance for the size of the device versus the amount of it that's screen area, because you want a lot of screen as much as you can fit, really. And also, it's an IPS display, so the viewing angles are excellent. And yeah, those two in combination, I guess, are the heart of 32-bit. Then you get onto things like the controls and the rest of it that Phil can talk about.
Indeed. So when wiring up the controls, we went for the standard four face buttons, D-pad, plus an analog stick, start and select, which is kind of your basic classic console controller layout. We actually had enough spare I/O pins that had no other real use that we could route a couple of them to the left and the right and call them hack headers, so that people who want to add either left and right buttons, some sort of analog triggers or whatever they might want, can add them to the side of the console or use those for hacks and mods. We've got more I/O routed to the top of the device for the programming header, for resetting it externally, for connecting stuff to the internal I2C bus. So if you want to throw away all of the code we've written for it and build something completely different that interfaces with peripherals, then you're quite within your remit to do that. It gives you the flexibility. And then to back that up, we've got a little vibration motor connected to a PWM, so you can get force feedback in games, which is quite nice, quite cool on a little handheld as well. We've got the DAC, well, it's the amp rather, which is connected to the audio output also on a PWM. Then we've got the...
It's actually on a DAC output.
Oh, a proper DAC output, yeah. It is effectively a PWM. Same difference. And then we've got... Then we've got the tilt sensor. I can't remember the part number, but that gives us kind of tilt steering control. And John put together a really nice kind of sand demo where you can turn the blit around and sand particles will slide from one side to another and skitter over each other. It's just really satisfying. So we've kind of gone all out with, I suppose you'd call it a relatively modern remit of input and output features, but in a classic console kind of style. So you can imagine... You're taking stuff from the Mega Drive and the SNES era, and you're updating that to have force feedback and tilt controls and all sorts of other new modern conveniences. It gives you a little bit more ability, I guess. And then you can go around.
Oh, that's a really important point. But you know, back in the early 90s, we didn't have MEMS sensors, or you know, I'm pretty sure we didn't. But if we did, they probably cost thousands of pounds and were the size of a trunk. You know, a fridge or something. It's only the fact that technology's moved on so much that these kind of features can be added so cheaply to a product, which means we can kind of go for that retro feel and kind of pitch towards retro gaming, but augment it with those kind of modern extras like the accelerometers, the vibration sensors, things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Nate, my co-host on the show, said a few shows ago that right now it's a very good time to be a geek because we have access to lots of stuff for, yeah, what, as you said, about, I don't know, a tenth of the price that that it was a few years ago. So yeah, when you talk about the 32 Blitz, it sounds like a really great device, and I can attest to that because I have one here, and I have tested many of the examples. I'm starting to try and understand how to write my own programs for that. But
we'll slow down on changing it, I think, so that makes it a bit easier.
Yeah, this beta phase is volatile, should we say. Like the API, the build tool chain, everything like changes pretty much week by week. But we're trying to kind of hone in on the right experience for everybody so that when it comes out to beta, we can say, right, we're more stable now. We're not super stable, but it's not going to change tomorrow, right? You can have a bit of fun for a while. We'll see how it goes.
I didn't know that it was hackable as much as you said, as with the Data Square C, you said, the button. So it seems to me like it's a game console, but it could actually be anything. Could be scientific. Well, not maybe scientific tool, but you know, to control stuff in a home automation system, or enhance the games that would run on the device using, I don't know, controlling LEDs, external LEDs or things like that.
It definitely could be. I think we've learned in the past to not try and be everything to everybody, especially when we're kind of scoping out a new product, and you'll get a bunch of people around in the company, maybe four or five, throwing ideas off each other. It's almost as important what you choose not to include mm-hmm. as what you choose to include, because you can end up with, I don't know if you know the reference, but Homer's car or whatever it is. There's an episode of The Simpsons where he designs a car, right, and ends up with like 12 different horns, and like it's just ridiculous. It's kind of like just adds everything he fancies yeah. at the time. And with product design of the type we do, it really is a balancing act between, and it's not just about price or difficulty to assemble it, or whether the parts are available, or, you know, what quality of part you pick. Do you pick this one because it's 16-bit, or this one because it's 12-bit, or whatever? A lot of it's about not making the experience confusing for the user, because mm-hmm. anyone can throw every feature onto a board, charge £200 and say, I'm done. But actually, I think the more important thing is saying, look, these are the valuable features that can work together to actually produce an experience. So while you can do a lot more with 32-bit, we have been very opinionated about what we've actually presented as the final package.
It's not an API feature, effectively.
No, we're not. But we're not trying to make it easy for people to use it for home automation mm-hmm. control or for this or for that. We're definitely all about the game development. That said, if you can, you know, set up a tool chain and get code running on the device, you can ignore all our stuff and do what you like. Yeah. It's open source at the end of the day.
Yeah. So what's the target audience for 32-bit? Is that developers?
Nostalgic developers of a certain age, I'd say between 30 and 50, something like that.
right.
Which is basically exactly me.
Yeah, me too.
This is a passion project, as in something we wanted to have, not necessarily, you know, obviously we want to share it with other people and get people involved in it and sell units, because we're a business at the end of the day, but we definitely built this one for us. And I think, I don't think it's the wrong choice, because I'm pretty sure there are enough software developers out there of a certain age who long for kind of retro gaming from the early 90s, you know.
We've had such great kind of return from the beta backers already that it just kind of shows we're at least somewhat on the right track.
Yeah. Oh, that's been incredible, hasn't it? Yeah.
You said you had feedback from the backers. The campaign on Kickstarter was funded in 8 hours, so you already had an indication that it was something that something that would please your audience.
That kind of thing's interesting, because, you know, we're not a huge company, but we do have quite a large audience already. You know, we've shipped something like 400,000 parcels worldwide since we started, so our customer base is quite big. Our mailing list is quite generous. So when we do something like a Kickstarter, as long as we're not silly about it, we can hit those kind of targets relatively easily, because we've got quite a wide audience to kind of transmit the message to on day one and say, hey, check out this thing. And, you know, we're really fortunate that we have customers who are genuine fans of what we do. You know, they come back time and time again, they'll try new things that we do. You know, not everything we do is perfect. And sometimes, you know, that's what it is, and we try to deal with those situations as best we can.
Not to toot our own horn too much, but we've worked hard to earn that reputation with customers, whereby when we do a new thing, they will trust us, they'll be on board straight away, and they'll be enthusiastic about it, which is really exciting and really nice place to be in, really.
Really encouraging. Let's come back to the platform. What are or will be the ways to develop games for the 32-bit?
We will have Lua, which will be the kind of entry point for people who don't want to get too involved with C, who want to be able to get up and running fast and want to basically just write code, throw it up the device and see results quickly without having to have the entire tool chain and all the libraries and editors and stuff necessarily installed on the computer. And then we have C++, which is the one step on from there, or if you've already got some development experience, that's where you go in to make games that are really fast performant, or to port Doom, or to just do crazy things.
And they're both fun, right? This is the key. I think Lua is definitely more focused at it's more focused at beginners, but actually, personally, I think so long as what I want to achieve, I could achieve in it. It's a damn sight quicker than getting into it, you know, developing something in C++. And, you know, I'm not going to have to worry about hard faulting or messing up my memory allocation or anything like that. You know, we've had it running on device before. We had to kind of cut it out of the build because the APIs were changing so fast that we couldn't keep the Lua bindings up to date in any sort of reasonable time scale. So we pulled it all out while we let things stabilize so we can bring it back in towards the end. But actually, when we had Lua running on the device, the performance is still astonishing. You know, it's a fast chip, and the instruction caches and the data caches are really make a big difference to that. And coding, you know, I had an example doing like real-time soft shadows that was all written in Lua. It's not, you can still achieve great things, I think is the key. It's not like a compromise.
It's definitely one of those cases where as soon as you've reached that level of competence that you're writing a game that's too complex for Lua, you're probably ready to move on to C anyway. And to kind of get that, it's still a fair hump, but it's...
You can definitely do more. You can definitely do more and do it more quickly if you write in C++, obviously. I mean, that's the nature of the beast. But what we're trying to do with the API is give you a really great set of tools that mean all of those kind of really hot loops aren't in your code base. They're in our code base. So things like, you know, rendering blitting screen or doing stretch blitz or processing large amounts of data, like doing the audio.
Node 7, I think, is a good example.
That kind of thing. What we try to do is hide that all behind kind of a couple of simple API calls. So whether you call it from Lua or whether you call it from C++, it's a few function call overheads. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Any plans for Python? And I know there are because we talked about that yesterday.
Probably not from us, at least initially. We promised Lua in C++, so we're going to completely focus on that. I would be astonished if someone doesn't get MicroPython running on it in relatively short time, because there are people who specialize in this. You know, they just literally just grab it, they'll have it done in half a day probably. But we've never ported MicroPython to a new device. It's not part of our ecosystem, so it would be an undertaking for us to start it now, and we just need to focus on the core experience.
Okay. Now, I'm a developer, so I know how to write C++, and I know how to place a sprite somewhere and detect a collision with a wall. But what I am not is a graphics designer or a sound designer. So how would I actually program a game if I don't have any talent in those fields?
Well, you don't have to have talent to produce something, right? I mean, I have no artistic talent at all, but I can at least, I still have fun with things like the demos and stuff, like doing the tilt demo and various effects. That's kind of what tickles me. But for people who just want to have a go at the coding side, we're including a bunch of assets. We got this great guy called Sam, who came over and actually spent some time with us in the UK. He's from Germany. He's a pixel artist who does some great stuff on Itch, and we saw his work and we were like, we really want to commission some sprite sheets to go with the device so that our users can basically use them as a jumping off point. So he's put together, I think it's like 8 sprite sheets that are, is it 128 sprites per sheet?
Oh, so 128 by 128, and the size is 8 pixels, which makes it 64 sprites.
64 sprites. Is it 16 by 16?
It is. Sorry, yes, it is.
Numbers, Phil, numbers.
Yeah. trying to do very simple math in my head on
it's 200, it's 256 sprites.
Shockingly.
So basically you've got like you have like a catalogue of over 2,000 sprites, I think it is, that you can use in your own games. And they're all completely royalty-free. Again, we paid him to produce the work completely for us. Again, it's open, license-free, everything. You can do what you want with it.
That's cool.
We already have someone using the pirate sprites to make a very piratical version of Bomberman, I think.
Yes.
That's really sweet.
That's nice.
But they're a nice set of sprites, because we kind of... It was great to get him over, actually, because we could go out, have a couple of beers, we could kind of talk about what we wanted to achieve, and we came up with these four themes for kind of classic game style concepts, and got him to put the sheets together. So we've got like a shoot 'em up, we've got a RPG style one, we've got a kind of a, what do you call that, kind of alien versus alien breed style top down.
It is a top down shooter, isn't it?
Top down shooter, yeah. And there's one of the platformer shooter, as well. We've got a platformer set. So the idea is that it's kind of something for everybody, but you can mix and match them if you want to. And then there's a few extra sheets that just contain kind of dingbats and symbols and things like that that you might want to bring in as assets or icons or whatever. So I think you can get started quite easily. The other thing that's nice about doing retro style games is that while great pixel art is a true skill, and it takes practice and you know, an eye for the an eye for it, just the restraint of only having an 8x8 pixel square, I think, lets people achieve a lot more than they could with just a blank canvas as big as they wanted it to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've drawn some icons that I'm not totally ashamed of. So that's, you know, that's something.
Yeah. It's less.
I was going to say, my Rainbow Ascent game, all of the graphics are just rectangles. There's no sprites in there or anything.
Yeah, yeah. It looks great. Yeah.
That works. Yeah.
So I think it's about being creative. And you did an Asteroids clone as well, right?
Oh, yeah, that's just...
Which is entirely vector-based, just geometry and nothing else. So it's not necessarily about drawing, you know, sitting there and churning your way through five different sprite sheets to get the perfect look. It's about try something new, experiment. See, you might not need sprites at all. Your audio might be entirely algorithmically generated, yeah. Or you might use the tracker, or you might ask a friend, or you might transpose some existing music. Or you might just play an MP3 file, because apparently that's possible now, according to one of our beta backers. Cool. Yeah. So, like, you know, I think the only limit is really kind of just what you're prepared to try. It's all about experimentation at the end of the day. And we'd hope that people in the community want to remix each other's projects as well, because, you know, we're making everything open. We're hoping that people will want to share their code. So someone might put together like a great engine for some platformer action. Someone else might pick that up, work on the sprite sheet, improve it, pass it back over. Someone adds the audio track. You know, why not?
Yeah.
It's possible to work that way. No problem.
So once I finish my, you know, top-notch game, the way to distribute that, if I wanted to pass the game to someone else who has a 32 bit, is that just, you know, just one file or a zip file, or is there a plan for some kind of centralized platform for games distribution, or is it just, you know, put that on GitHub and get it, compile it and run it?
Well, Phil knows the ins and outs of this more than I do, but I'm kind of architecting the project, so I'll tell him what I want it to be. And then hopefully it'll be like that. So the idea is that we'll have like a custom obviously we want people to share code, but you know, they don't have to, it's up to them. You will be able to pass a single binary file to someone, and that will contain like a packed header with all the details, with icon description, the name of the game itself, some of the metadata that kind of travels with it, and also includes the executable code and includes all the assets. So you can stick it on an SD card, plug it into the device, and away you go. Or you can use our command line tools that upload it via USB serial. So you can just say, you know, 32-bit prog file name or whatever. That's how it would work for C++ projects that are actually compiled, so everything built into that one package. When it comes to Lua projects, they would always, I think at this moment, would always run off SD card. So you'd have a folder that contains your various Lua scripts, your various asset files that you want to load off the SD card, and yeah, they won't be quite so tidy to pass around. Maybe we'll come up with a way of packaging them into, say, a zip file or something in the future that allows it to be handled on, you know, unpackaged on the fly as needed. But right now, we're kind of focused on getting it working. So yeah, it'll probably be a collection of files in a folder.
Do you have anything to add to that?
It's worth noting, as a consequence of how we built the system to allow you to develop on your desktop computer, you can take your 32-bit game and you can distribute it on Windows, Linux, and even in a browser via EMScripten as well. So it gives you that opportunity to share the game beyond just people using the 32 Blitz. So you're not putting a huge amount of time. Perhaps if you're really looking to take games development seriously, you can reach out to a wider market, maybe put your game up on itch.io, and then people with the Blit can download that version and everyone else can download the other versions. And it just kind of, it makes them a little bit more free, I suppose, in that sense.
Yeah, that's interesting, the fact that that I could run the examples and my little games that doesn't do much right now on my computer before sending it to the device, because, well, that takes a little extra time each time, and so the cycle of development is shortened by being able to run that on my computer.
Yeah, I think it's something we could never have stopped people from doing if they wanted to redistribute their games to other platforms. They've got the code, they've got the source, yeah. They could go through all the effort required to port it, like you say, but just making it possible straight out of the gate, why not?
Yeah.
Well, like, the experience is so different. I mean, I've had times when I'm trying to debug like a slightly gnarly problem in a project, and it only happens on device, so I'm having to transfer it over for every test.
Oh yeah, this is very true.
And that's no fun. I mean, it's all right to have to do that now and again, but I'd much rather load it up in Visual Studio, smash through a dev debug cycle over and over, step-by-step debugging. You know, 99% of the time, you can get all the way to something that will run on device just like that. Perfect. Why wouldn't we want that to be
a
thing?
Yeah, sure. It's always complicated to debug on the device.
It is. We're adding tools to the API for that, so you can expect that to improve over time. Things like being able to stream via the USB serial. Oh, you can actually do step-by-step debugging, but you need to buy a plugin programmer. Well, this is like a standard ST programmer. But we're looking at tools to help you stream debug information via USB serial to log files on the SD card as overlays on the screen. But I think the thing, not quite related to that, but the thing that surprised me more than anything else is that when I'm developing on my Windows machine, which is a fast machine, right? It's stupidly quick. When I'm running Visual Studio in debug mode, the speed of the compiled code is not that far off the same speed as it runs on the device in release mode.
Nice.
And like, that's pure chance. But actually, if I'm running something and if I'm getting like 5 milliseconds per frame rendering on my desktop, if I put it on the device, it's going to be roughly the same. I mean, obviously, there are edge cases where if I do something that's completely pathological and happens to run really fast on an i7 but is awful on the ARM architecture, then I'm not going to get that experience. But it still surprises me to this day that I can hack away on my Windows machine and like come up with something ridiculous. I've got like, so I was doing some stuff with 3D rendering, and I wasn't being careful about it. I was like throwing floating point numbers all over the place to just get something on screen. You run it on the device and it's actually okay. You're thinking, wow, there's so much potential to do more with this if you really spend the time on it. It's nice.
I was amazed that the speed of the different demos and examples, even the 3D rendering is so fast. I mean,
it's viable, right?
Yeah,
and that's what matters. And yeah, we're not even that skilled at it. You know, I'm a part-time bedroom 3D coder. Like, there are people who are way better at this stuff than me. And if I can get something up, you know, I've been developing for a long time, but I don't know anything about like optimizing the assembly or using things like the SIMD instructions or anything. Like, there's so much scope for someone who knows what they're doing to come in and just say, right, let's smash this. It's twice as fast now.
Yeah. Well,
what the hell were you playing at? That was so easy.
We had someone with the frame buffer copy, I think, come along and say, oh, you can use DMA 2D for that. You just have to do 4 passes or whatever.
Yeah, which we're going to end up influencing. It's great. Yeah, a guy in China who's got a device, he backed us on Kickstarter, jumped into the Discord. He's like, oh, I noticed you're doing da-da-da-da-da. We can do it with DMA 2D. Emailed me the source code, which we haven't integrated it yet, but we're totally going to do it this way. Why wouldn't we? And suddenly, he's just kind of fixed that for us.
Nice.
I mean, that's great. It worked before, but now it takes way less time.
Yeah. Talking about this person in China, do you have an idea of how many beta units have been sent? And did you send that all over the world?
We did definitely ship them all over the world. I think it was about 350. Is that right, Phil?
Somewhere in that region.
Something like that, because we've got the remaining units still to go out. we're basically waiting for the plastics now, for the actual case itself. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was something like 350, and I would say most of the communication with respect to the beta has happened on the Discord, which is the perfect place to do it, really. And out of those 350, there's maybe kind of 20 really involved contributors, which I think is a pretty good hit rate, actually. And a few of those are like way above and beyond, who are just incredible.
Yeah, I'm going to try and pop up more often on Discord, but probably to get information more than to provide information. But yeah, it was the community there is great. I mean, when I got on the server, I was greeted by almost everyone, and everyone is eager to help. So it's really nice. Yeah.
It's a really good atmosphere on there, and it's quite funny as well, because as we said earlier on, there are certain technical challenges that are completely fresh to us. We know they're possible. It's just a case of kind of slogging through it. And there's a couple of people on the Discord who will just jump in and have a go with you. Or, like, every step of the way, they're there, and we're throwing bits of code backwards and forwards and copying links out of the documentation and discussing possible ways to deal with it. And they're kind of like, you know, it definitely makes the experience more fun than Phil and I kind of just staring at each other in a room.
Well, it really is just us two who do anything really related to software at Pimeroni. So this is almost like suddenly having a team of people bashing away on problems, and it's really quite rewarding and quite fun.
Yeah, the power of the open source community always amazes me.
It is, and you know, we said it earlier on, but it's so important to us that this is open source. You know, as a company, we love to sell hardware, but actually, you can't contain something like this. If it's got legs, then we want people to use it and use it as varied, you know, in as varied a way as possible. Which is why things like running it in the browser is just great, because it means you can just throw an example over to your friends. You just send them a link; they can have a go at your game. Then it just makes the whole thing way more fluid, I think. It's much more interesting.
And it makes having distributed teams a lot easier when you can just, okay, hold on, I'm going to put that on the browser, and then refresh the page. Okay, I did that. Yeah, that's cool. Give me the thing. Yeah, it sounds really interesting. So how far, how close are we from some sort of release, maybe a 0.9 version that would be viable for the wider audience?
So from a purely logistical getting that out the door situation, all we're waiting on is the plastic. So that's the case itself, and the, you know, you've got a device in your hand now.
Yep.
And it's kind of constructed from layered PCBs, and it actually works incredibly well. I think we're quite proud of how well that works.
And I love it. I love it.
It looks cool, right?
Yeah, it looks cool.
But obviously, we promised with the Kickstarter that it would come in a, you know, a proper plastic shell, and we've spent a lot of time on the shell, and we've tried to make it as nice as we can, tried to make it look great, and just basically work well. So, you know, we need to ship that as part of the pledge. Having said that, we've still got tons to do on the software. So, you know, from Phil and my point of view, it's no bad thing that we're not quite shipping out the release units yet. But, you know, there's going to be a point at which our factory in Taiwan says, here you go, here's a load of plastic, go nuts. And I guess we're just, you know, it's not the best answer, but I guess we'll scramble at the time, won't we, Phil, to tidy up as much as we can.
We're currently mired in some really difficult problems, I think, it's a couple of really difficult things, plus all of the
Lua stuff. Luckily, we've done the Lua stuff before, so there's work to do.
Yeah,
we know how to do it.
We know what we're
doing.
Sitting
there and getting it done. The specific thing we're working on at the moment is what I mentioned to you earlier on before Phil came into the call. It's this idea of getting the making proper use of the external flash that we put on the device so that you can have a library of games installed simultaneously. Now, worst case, it's not a stopper, right? If we have to skip that, we can still release and let people get on with the device, fix it later. But we'd like to get that kind of thing sorted before putting the release units out there. So,
Well, it lets us do one really awesome thing, which is to preload all the released devices with a whole bunch of software and just send them to people and say,
that's
have
true.
A bunch
that
of games to play
nice.
Straight out of the game.
Again, it's not... we've got nothing that's kind of... We've got loads of stuff on the list. Like, it's terrifyingly long. But there's nothing on there that's an absolute stopper. It's just... It's that personal pride thing of I don't really quite want to let it go out the door without that getting sorted out first, you know. But there will come a point at which we know that those release units are going to go out, and at that point we're going to have to put down tools on certain aspects of the system, just tidy up that day one experience for people, and get the what we have, get that ready, rather than worrying about anything we don't have at that stage, basically. So
yeah, so
it's getting there.
So to help you with that long list, how can people contribute to the platform? I mean, I'm not talking about writing games, although that could help if you want to provide games from on the device. But is there something people can help you with that's directly linked to, I don't know, the firmware or some hardware drivers? Or do you need help in this area?
I would say that if people have a device and they have the skill set to kind of make that hardware sing, as in they already know how to do this stuff, if they want to jump on the Discord and chat about it, or even if they don't have the hardware, actually, but if you can read a data sheet, you'll kind of understand what's going on. If they want to jump on the Discord and talk to us, then we're all ears. Like, the code is there, it's on GitHub, people can dive in, have a go. Bits of it are quite painfully messy and still need to be kind of worked over, refactored. But I think, on the whole, we're doing okay. And actually, for people who've got the devices, almost one of the most useful things they can do is build projects, have a go, do their own thing, and let us know where the API falls short for them. Let us know where they're finding bugs.
Find the pain points, find the holes in the documentation, etc.
And, yeah, things like documentation. So every little helps. As they say, at the end of the day, it's not. We're not looking for one person to ride in on a horse and fix everything. It's going to take time for us to fix everything.
So even if someone is not a developer or doesn't have the device, that you talked about the documentation, so people can help with the documentation too. Do you have some kind of special format, some things that, they needs to be fixed in the documentation and that can be contributed to?
I think probably during this phase of the beta, we're not quite ready for that yet. But obviously, as we come to that release, one of those kind of tasks to get it ready to go out the door is to get the documentation a bit more tidied up. We're going to have to get to a point where we kind of lock down the functionality and say that's that, bar breaking bugs, basically, and that's what gets documented. The problem we've had to date is that obviously documenting is kind of not something that developers like doing when there's a big list of coding to be done. That's the case.
Tell me about
but
it.
Equally, the API, the way that we're working with the platform, changes so fast at the moment that you can't really nail anything down. So it's, there's going to be a point where we have to. And actually, the core 32-bit API, I would say, Phil, has been pretty stable for a few weeks now, actually. We had a flurry of changes early doors.
Yeah, for a few whole weeks, yeah.
Yeah, but a few weeks is good, right, compared to...
It is, yeah.
We used to have situations where someone would come onto Discord and say, hey, I haven't been online for 2 days, my project won't build. And then you just have a full list of all the changes that have been made. Like, you need to rename this to this, you need to include this header file instead. There would be a swathe of changes that they had to deal with, change all of their projects to fit those changes. And they've all been good changes. I'm happy with every single one we've made. Like, they're just much more sane.
It's
naming,
finally the pieces of the puzzle coming into place, I think, for us as well.
Exactly. But for finally the last
those questions,
the last 2 weeks, I think it's all been about the firmware, and we haven't actually touched the core API. So we may be at a stage where we can start thinking about actually locking that down, documenting it better. But I think another thing that's quite nice is, obviously, you can't get away with no documentation, as much as I'd love to. The API is smaller, like the surface of the API is small enough that people pick it up very quickly. I'm really obsessive about APIs being human and not like, I've written Win32 code. I've written stuff in .NET. And like, Just to do something simple, you don't have to create like a do something simple factory controller or whatever. It's literally like you write screen.rectangle, and that's how it's meant to be. That's the point.
I understand completely your point.
If you want to make it more complicated, go ahead and make it more complicated. But for us, we're going to just tell you to use the variable that's called pen and then call rectangle. And like that will put you a rectangle on screen. So, for us, the API, because it's pitched at beginners as well as more advanced people, the API is super important. It has to be human. It has to be understandable. The more advanced developers, at the end of the day, can just swap it out. They can change it. They can re-implement bits they want to, if they want to do.
People already have, more or less.
Well, that's it. If you want to manipulate the frame buffer directly because it's faster, whatever, people can do that. That's the nice thing. There's no real restrictions. So our API has to focus 100% on doing what you expect it to do when you tell it to do something. And to do the heavy lifting, because it's also going to become the back end for the Lua API, it has to do the heavy lifting where it doesn't make sense to attempt to do that in an interpreted language. So if I want to put a sprite on the screen, or say I want to put a 5x5 block of sprites, I'm doing like a boss fight, right? So my boss is 5x5 sprites, and he jumps around the screen, and he rotates, and he alpha blends in and out. You do not want to be doing that in Lua, right? You want to call screen.sprite, pass in the transform matrix, pass in the global alpha setting, and tell it where the sprite sheet is in that single one call, because behind the scenes, all of the tight loops, all of the hard work is being done by our firmware, our API. But that's what lets you get away with doing kind of big, impressive stuff in Lua on a device like this. So it's critical.
Well, it's a really interesting platform. I'm really looking forward to, producing something for it, and hopefully see the production units pretty soon. So, just to come back on that, that means that it's not possible anymore to get beta units now that the Kickstarter is.
Oh, we're torn on this because we kind of love them. They turned out so much more nice. Like I think almost if we'd have known they were going to be this good, we might not have even offered the plastic shell. Because there's something about it, the aesthetic of it, it feels quite nice in the hand. You know, it feels good. The weight's good. The controls are surprisingly good considering it's you've got limited granularity when it comes to PCB layering. So everything about it, I probably prefer it to the final. I don't know. Maybe I prefer it to the final unit. We'll see when they come through. I think the difficulty that we have is when it comes to pricing is that customers look at something and they look at something else and they will make a comparison. And the hard truth is that the beta units cost us as much to make as, in fact, they may be slightly more expensive than the retail units because plastics, while the molds are expensive, once you've paid for the mold, the per piece costs are very, very low. Whereas those PCBs and having someone like screw them all together is quite expensive, right? Especially when you do it in Sheffield rather than in Shenzhen. So I think there might be scope for it to be available. The other problem is because it's not fully contained. We weren't comfortable putting a battery in there by default. You know, there's all sorts of like little compromises, but
it's a beta unit, so we knew what we were getting when we ordered that on Kickstarter. And,
we made that super clear, right? That was really important that we told you exactly what was going on.
I think a few people were disappointed it wasn't more beta.
Yeah. We had people complaining saying, can you just send me a bag of parts? I'll deal with this. Like, no, you really do not want to deal with this.
I know, I'm going to keep this one. I mean, as long as it will live, and there's no reason to think it won't live as long as any other. But yeah, I'm going to keep that. Yeah, my goal is to try and do some stuff for my daughter. So, she's five. Five pretty soon. So, I'm just discovering this platform too, and so I'll be on Discord and getting information from the community to help on that.
Are you more excited about C++ or Lua?
I know both, so I don't know. I've used Lua in the context of World of Warcraft, and you can develop add-ons for World of Warcraft in Lua. So, I like Lua. I like C++. I'm going to try both.
I just think, like, I know a lot of people mention MicroPython, but the elegance, like, Lua's not perfect. We all know that. But the elegance and how lightweight it is and how nicely it binds into C, C++ projects, it's a cracking project. Like, Lua is I think it's underrepresented. I think it's underappreciated. And I think if their arrays started at zero, that would be different. I'd be like, genuinely, it's that stupid, isn't it?
I think people dislike it for some of the warts, yeah.
But for embedding on a device, it's so incredibly lightweight that you get that performance that you want, almost like it's running on the bare metal. And, you know, as a language, it's also so tight and so synced that it's not like syntax soup. There's not 10 different ways to do the same thing. And I really appreciate it for that. And I think it's a good choice for a platform like this. You can do a lot with it.
Interestingly, about a year ago, we had a web-based IDE up and running that let you write Lua and hit F5 and see it run next to your code in real time, which it just kind of reflects the sort of thing we could do with that, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that'll be coming back. And I think it was the debug build cycle was just great on Lua, because like you literally just edit the code and hit reset, and it's like it's up and running again with a new version. So I think, yeah, for a lot of people, that's going to be the experience that makes 32-bit for them.
Yeah, and if you can manage to have mass storage, USB mass storage on the device, and that's going to be even greater. So you can plug the device on the PC, edit the code, reset the device, and then nothing else to do. So it's great.
That's it. I mean, we're looking, you know, obviously the tools around 32-bit are coming together at the moment, but we're kind of keen to try and bring them into one single suite where you can edit your sprites, edit your audio, edit your maps, write your code, all in a single space, probably web-based, because that's how the world works now, right? You know, you want to be able to use it on a tablet, you want to use it on your Chromebook, you want to use it on a Mac. So the idea being you almost have like this, you know, as an IDE, it's not as complex as Visual Studio, but it's not as simple as, say, the Arduino IDE. It's somewhere in the middle that it has intimate knowledge of what kind of assets 32-bit uses, and it could let you manipulate those and work on a project with everything in one place. So I think that will be a great experience if we can get it right.
That sounds like MakeCode.
Is that the Microsoft thing?
Yes.
I haven't even looked at it. Is it any good?
I've looked at it. I don't have any device that I can use with it, but it seems like you abstract what the device can do and say, okay, I want to blink an LED. Obviously not on 32-bit, but on other platforms. I want to blink an LED, and you grab a block then
okay, so
add some devices and buttons and
this wouldn't be block based, obviously. I mean, I think what we're thinking about is a much more grown-up IDE, mm-hmm. if you like. Yeah. So
that said, I have talked to some people about possibly getting MakeCode Arcade up and running on the device, and it should be theoretically possible. But again, it's not one of those things we have the skill set to do in house. So it'll be something we'll kind of wait around and hope will happen.
Yeah, I think it. I think it's possible that something like that may come along, but I think our interest in what could be produced requires a level of advancement beyond kind of block level programming. So, you know, devices are already out there that are pitched entirely at that experience. I think we'd see ourselves as like where you go after that. And when you want to write some code, maybe you've done a bit of Python or something, but, you know, you're comfortable with the idea of writing code. At that point, I think that's when 32-bit can come along and become a tool.
Well, I think
that you
the great thing about that as a pitch is it gives people the opportunity to learn code, Lua being a prime example that is applicable to writing actual mainstream games and using in the games industry.
Yeah, I'm sure that code clubs or things like that, things for young children, that they would be interesting by such a platform, because, yeah, you know, kids love games, So if you can teach kids how to program and then tell them, look, you do that and you can go home with your console and play your game back home, they will like that.
I think so. I mean, I would have thought that I was into programming from an early age. My dad was a programmer, and I got into it on a Spectrum way back. And I guess I was probably around 13-ish when I started writing programs in BASIC. And I think Lua/Python probably take roughly the same kind of... they're a lot more complex. There's a lot more depth to them than BASIC on a Spectrum. But I think at around the same age, if you have the aptitude for it and the interest and you're prepared to put the time in, I think you can get stuff done. So it still works from a young age, but it's not kind of the... I think in the UK, schools start talking about Scratch at around 8 years old, and probably 32-bit isn't quite for you at that stage. You know, maybe 5 years later, you've had some exposure at school to initially block programming, then maybe you've moved into kind of Python and stuff. But ultimately, I think the biggest interest for this will come from people who not necessarily don't know how to code at all, but they already know how to code, but they just want to write some games because that's the fun bit of coding, right? They sit at work all day or at university doing whatever it's called now, computer science, I guess, I don't know. Or they sit at work all day writing banking systems, and in the evening they get home and they just want to blitz some pixels, man, and make some noise. And that's what it's all
yeah.
about.
Yes. Well, guys, thank you very much for joining me for this interview. I have a feeling that you're going to be back when when the device is shipping to talk more about the final product, namely the Breakout Garden.
I knew you were going to say Breakout Garden.
I had no idea. Go ahead.
Because that's a really nice concept. So, I'm pretty sure you're going to be back on the show before long.
It's been a pleasure.
Where can people find more about you guys on social media or somewhere else?
Follow us on Twitter. We are by far the most active on Twitter. So just search for Pimeroni and we're on there. Other than that, we're terrible at social media. Because you know, Twitter's like 280 characters or less, we can just about deal with that in a day.
All right. Well, it was a pleasure to have you and to talk about this awesome platform that the 32-bit is. Thanks again for joining me. And as I said, you will be back if you want to.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to talk about Breakout Garden. There's a good story behind that one. So.
Oh, no, so now I'm interested.
Not now. I got to go.
Yeah, I know. Well, thanks. Have a good evening.
You
and,
too.
Talk to you soon, guys.
Great
Bye-bye.
Stuff. Cheers. Bye.
Cheers. So that was our interview. Once again, I would like to thank John and Phil from PureManish for accepting to appear on this show. It was great. I mean, the device is great, and the people who do this device are great too. It's a shame that. That they are going to sell it with the plastic around, as we said earlier before we started recording, we talked about that together, and then I talked about that with them. That it's really nice. I'll put some picture in the show notes. Even though the buttons are not labeled, and you know it's really a raw design. It's really nice like that. So. Well, maybe they can. Maybe they have a few extras, and they will send that. That's going to be a collector, I think, someday.
I kind of need the case for me because I'm a bit of an animal in pants, and I break everything. So the more case and plastic layers, the better, you know. Because I don't know what I just. It's not that I'm accident prone, but maybe I am a little bit accident prone, and so But it does look really neat without the case. Maybe a clear case, you know, like back in those really popular in the 90s, you know, five years ago. but yeah, that's...
Maybe I can 3D print one.
But it's very inspirational to see this device. It just makes me think back to my days of when I did some game programming in my youth. And it makes me want to, you know, revisit all that for sure. I mean, to take a little time and maybe, you know, figure that out. You know, I've always enjoyed the platformers, and I had my own little take on a platformer, but the that would be fun to really revisit and look and do and submit that up. But the but yeah, that'd be really fun to play with for sure. I would get a huge kick out of that. I just need a little more time.
Yeah, don't we all? Yeah. The great thing is that you can grab the GitHub repo and compile that for Linux or Windows, and, you know, make your game without even having a device. And then, you know, once you get your hand on the device, flash that, and of course there's going to be problems because it's not exactly the same platform. But a lot of things can be made with the Windows or the Linux version of the game. So hopefully this is gonna be a great product. And I myself, I'm still trying to find an idea. I always find it a lot easier to have a goal. So I have a project in mind, and then with that in mind, explore APIs than just, you know, running examples and thinking that could be great. So I'm going to try and think about something to build for the 32-bit. So yeah, I'll keep.
It always makes me think, because I still have all my my assets from my Amiga programming days.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not that hard to convert those graphics over, and I could still use the Disney Animation Studio from like 1993, and probably just, you know, because it's. Yeah, I don't remember what the resolution was on that, but no, I did most of my drawings in 320 by 200, so I'm sure it can scale fine.
Yeah, it's 300. It's 320 by 240. So.
Okay, well there we go. So I could definitely do that.
Just be a little, and you can still have you can still have a status bar at the bottom or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So that might be kind of a fun excuse then to tie in some of my old tech, my retro tech, into helping to, you know, build some of these things. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. All right. So I think it's almost time to finish this episode. So we're going to do what we did last time, and hopefully in the next episodes and in the next episodes to come. That's the Thingiverse thing of the episode. And for this one, I selected something that I've printed a few months back. And it's called the Monster Mouth Headphone Holder Clampable. So that's a huge support for your headphone. And then you also print a screw, and then you can clamp that to your desk and fix it. I can, let me get mine. I also will put some
nice
features. So, and I added some how do you call that, things. You know, to avoid making indents in my desk. So yeah, and there's the screw.
You put like little rubber feet on that.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rubber feet. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
So you can see that I've printed it a few months back, and it's already bent a little because I put it a little bit too much. But it's really sturdy, so it's gonna. It's gonna last for a long time, and I'll just print another one when this one.
Yeah, that'd be a fun one to redo and change it for my situation here, because I'm in my basement. I'm a little bit of a basement. Mm-hmm. I am my own troll, and put it on my ceiling here, which is, you know, floor joist, and just kind of maybe just change how that's done, put it at a right angle, and then I could have all that stuff routed above me. That would actually be really neat.
Uh-huh. And then you can submit that to Thingiverse, and we could feature it in a future episode.
Yeah, why not? I could even do like a little, like you did, and do like a little Fusion 360 video on that.
Yes. Oh, that would be awesome. Yeah.
I have to look and see what the pitch is on that screw. But yeah, that's very cool. I like that. It's handy. It's like a little problem solving right there.
I like practical prints, you know, things that
for sure
solve problems. So or create new ones sometimes.
Well, then that's new problems to solve.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which creates absolutely new problems you have to find a solution for.
Yeah. Yes. Someone else. Well, I can create a problem and someone else can find a solution.
Right. Yeah. I'm a master at creating problems.
Oh, okay. I can try and find solutions for your problems.
I am hoping.
Right. For us, it's been a very short recording, but the episode is going to be quite long because this interview was an hour. So
it was a lot. It's a lot to chew on, this episode. Lots of meat in this one. Very few bones to spit out. Lots of meat.
So exactly.
It's great. And if you're vegetarian, lots of eggplant. Mm-hmm. Eggplant parmesan. Extra sauce.
Wow. It's always better with extra sauce.
Yeah, it always is. Yeah.
Thank you for everyone who downloaded our previous episodes and for the kind feedback we have received. Once again, thanks to John and Phil for appearing on the show. You can get in contact with us by sending an email at feedback@makerscorner.tech or by following us on Twitter. We are @makerscornerpod. If you want to chat with us in a more lively fashion, you can join our Telegram group at t.me/makerscornerpod. Unless otherwise stated, this podcast and the interview are released under a Creative Commons by Attribution share-alike license, which means you can do pretty much whatever you want with it as long as you credit us as the original authors. And if you publish anything based upon this episode, you have to release it under the same license. Well, thanks, Nate, for joining me once again this fortnight.
It's always great seeing you, so it's a good time.
Yeah, even though this week has been quite short, but yeah, it's always a pleasure.
Little high and by, and it's, a little chat here and there. We're good to go.
Yeah, absolutely. We will be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Maker's Corner. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Ciao, ciao.
See yous.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.